Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for business owners and investors looking to protect their assets, save on taxes, and build their wealth. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Tax Tuesday. A little bit of a change from the norm. My name is Tony Covey. I'm an EA and Director of Professional Services here with Anderson, and also your new host, bringing tax knowledge to the masses. And we've also got Jeff here.
Hello, Jeff Webb, CPA. You guys have heard me before, I'm sure.
CPA but, to the stars.
Yeah, Tony and I are going to wing this today, and I know you guys are going to miss Toby, and he should be back for the next Tax Tuesday, but Tony and I are going to plow through the questions as we can.
Yep, absolutely. We got a ton of them for you. As usual, follow us on social media. You can get us on Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn, Instagram, and Twitter, and give us a call. House rules, Tax Tuesday rules, ask live and we will answer before the end of the webinar. We actually have people on deck. We have a CPA, bookkeeper, an attorney on standby to answer your questions as they come in. You can send in your questions at taxtuesday@andersonadvisors.com. If you need a detailed response, you will need to become a platinum or a tax client. This is fun, fast, and educational. We want to give back and help educate. Opening questions. So, I am the custodian of my son's UTMA account. Now that he is of age, what is the best way to convert this account under his name only? Are there any legal or tax consequences to consider? That's a good one. How do you switch from a regular IRA to a solo 401k to invest in real estate and forego UBIT or UDFI tax? Do I set up an entity to move funds? Does it matter how much you have in the IRA versus what you make in self-employment income? We'll answer that. Because of the new AB 5 law, fun, California, my clients can no longer hire me as an independent contractor. Well, that sucks. Instead, they are hiring out-of-state contractors. Do I need to switch to an S-Corp or move my company out of California? We'll answer that. We are a preschool and received coronavirus relief, COVID-19. Will the PPP loan forgiveness amount, the grants, and the EIDL, the EIDL, advance be taxable as income? We'll answer that. I have solely owned a second home long-term in New York. Do I need to file taxes separately from my wage-earning wife to minimize my capital gains tax, considering my present income is limited to Social Security? We will answer that. My wife and I own several rental properties and manage them ourselves. Does setting up a corp to manage the rental properties, each in their own LLC, very good, make sense from a tax standpoint? No employees and mostly do the maintenance ourselves. So we'll answer that for you. If you are self-employed, are you able to deduct the purchase of a vehicle on your taxes? So Jeff, that's going to be a good one for you. A relative who is a non-resident alien resides overseas and invests in a U.S. real estate syndication as a limited partner. He receives a K-1. If there is too much withholding on Form 8805 and there is a refund amount shown on Form 1040-NR due to over-withholding on Form 8805, will the IRS refund the money directly to me or directly to the 1040-NR filer or through the partnership? The partnership said they received a tax refund and is sending it to my relative, but the amount is substantially different from what's on the 1040-NR. Well, that was a mouthful, but we will answer that for you.
I picked that one just so you could read it.
You're very good, Jeff, and this is why we love you. If the passive activity losses, PALs, from a sold property are not large enough to completely offset the capital gain on the sold property, can the PALs from any other owned properties also be used to offset the capital gain on a sold property? We'll answer that. California has proposed a wealth tax. California strikes again. California has proposed a wealth tax that would affect current and past residents. As a previous California resident, what can I do to minimize my potential liability for this tax? What is the realistic jurisdiction of the Franchise Tax Board? We'll answer that. I just started trading stocks and am currently trading options. How are these stock options taxed? Is there a process to reduce them? We'll answer that. We did pick a lot of questions. I hear there are more tax benefits for LLCs. What steps do I need to take to change my business from a sole proprietor to an LLC? We'll answer that. What is the preferred method to be taxed in an LLC when starting an assisted living business? C-Corp or S-Corp? That's always the question. I bought some dirt and am building a house for resale.
I love that.
I bought some dirt, yes. Do I need to keep it for a year before selling for long-term capital gains? Is my basis the lot and the build cost? That is a very good question, and we will answer that. If there are no capital gains on selling a house in one state, but the former owners moved to a new state prior to the sale, are there taxes in the new state? State taxes, fine. We'll answer that. All right. So don't forget, we have a ton of Anderson events to keep you educated, tax and asset protection. That's our foundation, structure implementation, giving you the tools tax-wise, giving you the tax tools, start and run a nonprofit. Let's give back. Infinity investing, let's learn how to invest. And then we have some Anderson exclusive events. You can find out all about them at AndersonAdvisors.com events. All right, we're getting started. First question. I am the custodian of my son's UTMA account. Now that he is of age, what is the best way to convert this account under his name only? Are there any legal or tax consequences to consider? What say you, Jeff?
The way these UTMA accounts work is account is set up for your son. If it has interest or making any kind of money at all, it is income, taxable income to your son. Most of these expire once the child becomes an adult. And it really depends on the state. Some states say for UTMA purposes, and UTMA is Uniform Transfer to Minors Act. So once they become 18 or 21, all the money in that account becomes theirs. You normally just have to talk to the bank where the account is. These are usually some kind of bank accounts or maybe even a brokerage account, about converting the account over completely to your child. Are there any legal or tax consequences to consider? No, because you've been recognizing income all along if you had to file a tax return. But otherwise, there's really no transfer between people or anything. So there are no tax consequences. Now, the one thing I will say is if you give a large chunk of money in one year into one of these UTMA accounts, it's just like any other gift, and you may have to file a tax return just to report the gift.
Fantastic. All right, let's go to the next one. How do you switch from a regular IRA to a solo 401k to invest in real estate and forego UBIT or UDFI tax? Do I set up an entity to move funds? Does it matter how much you have in the IRA versus what you make in self-employment income? Yeah, let's look at this in chunks.
Yeah, exactly.
One does not simply forego UBIT or UDFI. It really is UDFI, sure, because in a solo 401k, UDFI is not applied. UBIT right. Still is. So we really have to look at what the activity is that you're doing in the solo 401k. Do you want to go into what UBIT is, Jeff?
Yeah. Like you said, the UDFI is never going to apply to a 401k. It does apply to an IRA. As far as a UBIT goes, that is unrelated business income tax. And the key word here is business. They're looking at a trader business. Investing in real estate is typically not considered a trader business. What they're looking at for trader business is maybe you invest in a retail store or something like that. Something that would be what you would consider a normal business. Now, as far as how do you switch from a regular IRA to a solo one 401k, and I think that was the next question, wasn't it, Tony?
Well, no, the next question is, do I set up an entity to move funds? And I think maybe they're referring to the sponsoring there.
Because the 401k is going to have a sponsor, right?
Right.
So easiest is a C corporation or S corporation. A sole proprietorship is not going to qualify. A partnership could qualify, but it's complicated to say the least. So what you would do is you would have a, say you had a corporation sponsoring this 401k. The way you get it started after you set up the 401k is if you have a regular IRA, you can roll that IRA into your solo 401k. So if you have a couple hundred thousand dollars in that IRA, you have your starter money for investing in that real estate without, you know, having to have the company throw money into it or even possibly have a salary and deferring money. The easiest way is to roll over a large IRA into solo 401k. If not that, then there is could be employee contributions through salary or employer contributions based on salary.
Right. So we unpacked that for you. So let's pack it back up. So what you're going to do is you need to first set up your sponsoring entity. To Jeff's point, we recommend a C or S corporation typically. Then you'll be able to set up the solo 401k sponsored by the corporation. And then you're going to be able to roll your IRA over into the solo 401k and you're good. Doesn't matter how much you have in the IRA versus what you make in self-employment income. I don't know that we addressed that, but I think what they're asking is how to make contributions to the solo 401k, and you're kind of going down the right road there. You are looking at earned income from the corporation to yourself to be able to make a contribution to the solo 401k. Or did I just repeat something you already said, Jeff?
No. When you're talking about self-employment income, that's more along the lines of a partnership or a sole proprietor, where you account the self-employment income to make your contributions. Otherwise, in an S corporation or corporation where you typically see the 401k, you have to have salary compensation to yourself in the form of some kind of payroll to make those contributions to the solo 401k. The IRA rollover you can do regardless of whether you have salary or not once you have that solo 401k set up.
Right. So we have two different things happening. You've got your IRA rollover, which you can do all right away, like Jeff said. And then you've got your self-employed income. Typically, we're wanting you to look at a CRS corporation for that. So we're talking salary. Anything else to add to that one, Jeff?
Nope. Toby sometimes has to translate for me too.
I'm a good translator. All right. Because of the AB5 law, my clients can no longer hire me as an independent contractor. Instead, they are hiring out-of-state contractors. Do I need to switch to an S corporation or move my company out of California? Can't wait to hear what you have to say about that, Jeff.
For those who don't know about AB5, I don't know how you can not know, even if you don't live in California. There's so much news about it.
Exactly.
There's a three-pronged test to determine whether you are truly an independent contractor or not. And the first two tests are the typical, do you control your own schedule and so forth. It's the third test that really makes it difficult. The worker is customarily engaged in an independently established trade occupation. What it gets down to is you got to be doing something that the company doesn't normally do, which is why Uber and Lyft are really ticked off. So back to your question, yes, they are hiring out-of-state contractors. I'm not sure how that works for out-of-state contractors, because if I live in Utah and I'm working in California as a Lyft driver, that income's still going to be subject to California law. Now, if it's more consulting type work that you can do from out-of-state, then yeah, that makes perfect sense that they could hire those people.
Well, and, you know, I'll add there, here's what I have trouble with this one. Let's just say you set up an S corporation in Texas. You're still performing the service, or if you're still performing the service in California, there's where I have an issue with trying to use this strategy.
Yes, I think the only difference is what he asked first, do I switch to an S corporation? So if your clients were paying your S corporation, I'm not sure that AB5 would apply in this case. because the S corporation cannot be an independent contractor. They're their own entity. Have you run into that at all, Tony?
I have not, but this has come up before, and I just can't commit. I have a form over substance issue with setting it up for that purpose, but can it work? Possibly.
Yeah, I think it might work. C Corp would work even better, but there are different issues with that because a C Corp is a completely independent entity.
Taxpayer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's its own taxpayer. Moving my company out of California, if we're talking about Schedule C or even a partnership, I think you would have to physically move. You couldn't work from San Diego and say your company's in Nevada and defeat AB 5. I think that would be a fail. But you could possibly be an S corporation or C corporation in California under AB 5. Now, the other downside of this is the $800 a year franchise fee for having a corporation or S corporation in California.
But they're going to put it outside of California.
True. I'm thinking they might be able to put it inside California and be exempt from AB 5.
But that's a possibility. My concern there is if the S corporation is performing a function of the hiring entity. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I think AB 5 was designed to attack companies who have a large number of independent contractors. That doesn't justify kind of what I'm pushing at, but I don't even know if that was considered when they wrote this law.
Right. So what I'm looking at is let's put it into context. We're going to put an Uber driver in an S corporation in Texas. S corporation filed in Texas, but we're Ubering in California.
Right. That's not going to work. If you're actually performing work in California, that's always going to be a problem.
That was my issue.
Yeah. If you're
doing shake out under audit.
Yeah. But I'm thinking if you're doing strictly consulting under an S corporation, I don't think they can make your corporation an employee, but they may try to make the employees within the S corporation employees of the contractors.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's what I thought.
We never know what's going to happen with California.
It's too new. Yeah. All right. So let's keep rolling here. We are a preschool and received coronavirus relief. Will the PPP loan forgiveness amount, the grants, and the EIDL advance be taxable as income? The answer is no. Those are loans and a grant, so that's not income. Well, the one thing that is worth noting, I don't know if you've already gotten your loan forgiven, is that if you did receive an EIDL grant, let's say it was $10,000, that amount is not going to be forgiven on the PPP loan. So $10,000, if you got a grant for $10,000, $10,000 of the PPP loan will not be forgiven. That's just something to keep in mind as it relates to that. Anything to add on that one, Jeff?
So on the PPP loan forgiveness amount, that is not taxable income. However, what the IRS and the Treasury Department is preaching pretty much against the will of Congress is anything you pay for with that PPP loan is not tax deductible. So they're kind of using a backdoor method to get around what Congress proposed when they came up with this loan forgiveness. We're hoping before the end of the year to see some legislation to overturn that.
Yeah, obviously we don't agree with that at all. So hopefully that will be rectified.
Correct.
Okay, so I have solely owned a second home long-term in New York. Do I need to file taxes separately from my wage-earning wife to minimize my capital gains tax, considering my present income is limited to Social Security number? No.
Yeah.
Jeff?
I actually tested this one, Tony. And boy, talk about it. It depends. It primarily depends on how much your wife is earning. I found that if she's earning around $100,000, you could save a couple thousand dollars if you file separately. On the other hand, if she's only making about $50,000, if you file separately, it's going to cost you about twice as much in taxes. Then again, when you get up to the $200,000 level, again, filing jointly works out better. So this is one of those cases where you really need to look at it. And most tax preparers I know we do will actually test this as part of the tax preparation, which works out better for you.
All right, perfect. My wife and I own several rental properties and manage them ourselves. Does setting up a corp to manage the rental properties, each on their own LLC, make sense from a tax standpoint? No employees and mostly do the maintenance ourselves. We typically do recommend looking at a corporation to either manage the rental properties or manage the LLCs that hold the rental properties. And good on you putting those properties into their own separate LLCs. That's exactly what we would recommend for asset protection purposes. But for tax purposes, the corporation can be a very good tax planning tool. Would you like to share why, Jeff?
The corporation allows us to deduct some items that normally are not deductible. One of the big ones is the medical reimbursement plan, Section 105 plan, it's called, that allows you to, the corporation, to reimburse for medical expenses. There's other expenses that can be reimbursed, certain educational expenses. We already talked about management fees coming in would be income to it. The corporate meetings, what we call, sometimes call the 280A deduction, those can all be substantial deductions. And why we care about that is when we have a corporation manage the rental properties, the rental property income is probably going directly to you or through some kind of pass-through. Whereas if we pay a management fee to the corporation, that decreases the amount of revenue coming directly to you, transfers it to the corporation. And then the corporation has these other deductions that may reduce or eliminate any tax on the corporation. So that's one of the reasons why we're interested in this.
We've got a live question that asks, would a land trust be better as far as asset protection? And the answer to that is no. The land trust does not provide asset protection. A land trust can help in a number of ways in your structure, depending on your set of facts and circumstances. It can also help with anonymity. But the land trust does not provide liability protection as the LLC or a C corporation would.
Right.
Anything else to add to that one, Jeff?
Nope.
All righty, let's keep moving. If you are self-employed, are you able to deduct the purchase of a vehicle on your taxes? If so, how?
You are able to. Let's start off with the best scenario. As you have purchased a vehicle that is used 100% in your business, say you do construction and you bought a heavy-duty pickup to haul equipment around and so forth. So that vehicle could be put in your self-employment business. If it meets certain qualifications, it could be completely deducted in the first year under the bonus depreciation or Section 179. But again, it needs to be 100% business use. Once you start dropping down below 100% business use, then you're only going to be able to deduct a portion of that same amount. And so we sometimes see people get in trouble saying, this vehicle is used 100% in my business, but it turns out they're commuting, they're using it for personal mileage, or not tracking any of this mileage. And if you're audited and IRS sees 100% used vehicle, they're going to want to double check it. They're going to want to check you on it, and you're going to have to validate that as far as how the vehicle was used and so forth, the mileage. But yeah, Toby often talks about that. He prefers that you put the vehicle in your own name and being reimbursed for the expenses. And one of the things he says is commercial insurance on a vehicle is expensive. If they know you're using it for work, it's a problem. So Toby likes to push the personal reimbursement for a personal vehicle. A lot of people like that giant deduction in the first year if they can get it. Most cars are not going to be subject to that deduction. Only trucks and SUVs are going to qualify for that bonus depreciation. You got anything else?
No, I mean, I'm with Toby on that. I prefer the reimbursement mileage or actual expense method. It may be a little bit more conservative, but yeah, I agree with Toby on that one. If there's going to be any personal use of the vehicle, you really rather not have that in the business name versus in your personal name. And it does come attached with sometime higher costs for insurance, for registration, and things of this nature. So, oh, this is the fun one. Okay. Just give me 5 minutes to read through this. A relative who is a non-resident alien resides overseas and invests in a U.S. real estate syndication as a limited partner. He receives a K-1. If there is too much withholding on Form 8805 and there is a refund amount shown on Form 1040-NR due to overwithholding on Form 8805, will the IRS refund the money directly to the 1040-NR filer or through the partnership? The partnership said they received a tax refund and is sending it to my relative, but that amount is substantially different from what's on the 1040-NR. All right. What say you, Jeff?
I'm going to jump right into the middle of this question where they're saying the partnership said they received a tax refund. That doesn't sound quite right to me. Does it sound right to you, Tony?
No, not at all.
Okay. So typically what happens is when you have a non-resident alien who is investing in U.S., who is receiving what is called effectively connected taxable income, money earned in the U.S., exactly as this question said, they receive a K-1 and they withhold generally 30% of any money received and send it to IRS. As a required law, the penalties for not doing it are substantial, and that's why they will always do it. Depends on what country they're from and what the tax treaty is, but you can generally suppose it's going to be 30%. So oftentimes that withholding is way more than it's going to be due. So you need to complete that 1040-NR, and there is a line to report how much was withheld on Form 8805. And just like a regular 1040, you figure the tax, how much was withheld. And if there's an overpayment, it will be refunded to the taxpayer, the person who files a 1040-NR. It typically will not, I've never seen it with repaid to the partnership.
Right.
So that's why it's important. Yeah, they've already withheld on you. And the reason they withhold so much is a lot of people don't file that 1040-NR. They don't file a tax return. IRS doesn't care. They already got 30% of your money. So they're fine with that. So it's generally a very good idea to complete this tax return if you've got any kind of withholding, whether it's this 8805 or your W-2 or so forth.
Yeah, you picked this question, so I'm saying it's all you.
That's all I got.
All right. Nice. Let's keep going. If the passive activity losses, PALs, from a sold property are not large enough to completely offset the capital gain on the sold property, can the PALs from any other owned properties also be used to offset the capital gain on a sold property?
Okay. I'm going to do some back to basics teaching on this one, so I apologize. Passive activity losses, PALs, as we call them, can only be offset by passive activity income. So here's the rub. So I sell a property, I have all these passive activity losses in this entity or in this property. Well, those losses are released automatically when you dispose of a property. So let's say I have $50,000 of PALs in there. Fine, they're gone. When you sell the property, it is true that it's subject to capital gain, but it's something special she called passive capital gain. That is, if you have any capital gain on the sale of a rental property, that gain is considered passive, and that can offset other passive losses. So if I have two properties and they each have $50,000 passive losses, and a $100,000 gain on this sale, well, 50 is going to be released from the disposing of the property. And the other 50 on the property I'm still holding on to, that's going to get released because I have all these passive capital gains to offset those losses.
That would be, though, if you had not made the election to aggregate, correct?
Correct. Once the problem with aggregating, and by aggregating, you're 99 times out of 100, that applies to real estate professionals. And the only way to do real estate professionals successfully with multiple properties is you have to aggregate all your properties. That says that they're all one activity, even though you still report them separately. What happens when you aggregate is if you sell one of, say, three properties, it's not considered completely disposed of. So it does not release that gain or that loss by itself. You have to actually dispose of everything that's aggregated.
Substantially now, all.
Substantially. So if you buy 10 properties this year and you immediately become a real estate professional, it's not going to be an issue because you'll never have any passive losses. Where we see this affecting people is I've been had these rental properties for 10 years and I have all these passive losses and now I want to be a real estate professional so I can start deducting some of my losses. Those passive losses that are already there get locked in to that aggregation until you dispose of everything that's aggregated, or as Tony said, substantially all.
Substantially all. Yep. So we do run into that. We have run into that with, you need to look at it. If you want to, you know, qualify as a real estate professional and you've already got a ton of suspended PALs, we need to look at that and look at, are you planning on selling any properties in the near future? Those are things we need to take into consideration.
You can't see me, but I'm emphatically nodding my head.
Very good. Next time we need to have your beautiful mug on the webcam, right? We'll crop you up. We've got to have people seeing you agree with me for once. Anyway, let's keep going. California has proposed a wealth tax that would affect current and past residents. As a previous California resident, what can I do to minimize my potential liability for this tax? What is the realistic jurisdiction of the Franchise Tax Board? It depends on who you're asking. Are you asking the Franchise Tax Board? They're going to say they have all jurisdiction everywhere. Go ahead, Jeff.
So this wealth tax that's been proposed, that hasn't been approved, is a 0.4% tax on your net wealth if your net wealth is greater than $30 million. So it's going to affect, I think they said the top 0.1%, might have been a little slightly higher than that. As far as current and past residents, I don't think, if you're already out of California, I don't think it's going to affect you. The issue that's always been with California is they never let you leave. We've had people who have moved out of the state and typically at the higher end of the income level. And they say, because of your social connections here and blah, blah, and you have these friends and you have a second property here, you're still a California resident. That's always kind of been an issue. So I don't think you have to worry about it. I don't think, like I said, this law has not been passed. But yes, there is a concern that rich people are going to be moving out of California left and right. And there's a second reason for that is California already had the highest state tax of 13.3%. And they are adding on a bracket to raise that tax rate to 16.8%. So between the wealth tax and this higher bracket, people who make money are going to get, wealthy people are going to get hit pretty hard. And there's been some analysis that they could lose more money than this wealth tax is actually making for the state if they have a plethora of people moving outside the state.
All right. I just started trading stocks and am currently trading options. How are these stock options taxed? Is there a process to reduce them?
Stock options, by their very nature, are typically going to be taxed as short-term capital gains or losses. As a capital loss, they're going to be subject to a limitation of $3,000 of loss that you can recognize each year. You have to carry over the rest. As short-term capital gains, they're going to be subject to your normal, your ordinary income tax rates. So if you're in the 22% bracket, then you're going to be paying 22% on any gains, any net gains. Is there a process to reduce them? Not really that I can think of. I will say that the typical investor who invests in options doesn't do as well as they would hope. They typically have more losses than they do gains. Trading stocks is a different issue. Stocks that you held long-term are going to be subject to long-term capital gains, which brackets are 0, 15, and 20%, I believe. Is there still a 10% rate?
No.
I think, yeah, I thought they'd eliminated that one. And the reason I say that trading the options are going to be subject to short-term capital gains and losses is they're typically expire within a few months unless you invest in what's called LEAPS, which are long-term options that are a year or more. But most people who are investing in options are getting in and getting out fairly quickly. What did you think about the part of, is there a process to reduce them? Anything come up to you?
Is there a process to reduce the capital gains?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I mean, the structure that we use, or one of them that we use here at Anderson, gives you the opportunity for potential income splitting. So you can put the brokerage account in your LLC, have that LLC taxed as a partnership, have your managing member of the LLC as your C corporation, do a small percentage, somewhere in the neighborhood, 10, 20, maybe even less, more or less. And then you can also do, so immediately you have a percentage of the gain going up to the corporation, take advantage of all those lovely deductions that Jeff was talking about a little bit earlier. And then if you wanted to do more, you could. You can do what's called a guaranteed payment from your LLC to your corporation to create a deduction that flows through to your personal tax return. So there are things you can do to kind of mitigate the tax consequence, but you know, you definitely want to get in for tax planning.
Good answer.
Got my Toby on today. all right, let's see what we got next. Okay, I hear there are more tax benefits for LLCs. What steps do I need to take to change my business from a sole proprietor to an LLC?
I don't know who did this question, but I'm guessing you probably haven't heard Toby talk about LLCs before. There are absolutely no benefits for tax benefits for an LLC. The LLC is primarily for liability protection.
That is going to depend on how you have the LLC taxed.
Correct. You have to choose how that LLC is taxed. Is it still a sole proprietor? LLCs can be sole proprietors. They can be partnerships. They can be S-corps. They can be corporations.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so, this does imply that you're going to be treating your LLC as a sole proprietor or as disregarded. So I get where you were going with that, Jeff. Mm-hmm. But you definitely want to look at, if you're looking for tax benefits, we can still look at an LLC. We just need to look at how that LLC is taxed. Usually it's always best to have a separate taxpayer, and that's going to be a C corporation. So we can move things off of your personal tax return, put them on the corporate tax return, and take advantage, once again, of all of those benefits Jeff was educating us about a little earlier.
Right. Determination of what type of entity you want the LLC to be, or I should say taxing entity you want it to be, is going to depend primarily on what the business is. Mm-hmm. Part of the decision process is to see what type of business you have, what your goals are, and so forth, and then make a determination of there of which entity would fit you best. Sometimes it's not going to be an LLC. Sometimes it's going to be Inc. corporation or possibly a limited partnership. But in general, I think the LLCs do everything we need the LPs to do, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, we used to use LPs quite frequently, but thanks to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the LLC became a lot more attractive than the LP was. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act took away that Schedule A 2% investment expense deduction that you were able to take previously. And right. So we had to pivot and move to the LLC and change our strategy there a little bit. All right, let's keep rolling. What is the preferred method to be taxed in an LLC when starting an assisted living business, C or S corporation? And the famous answer to that question is going to be, it depends. Do you want to tell them why?
Well, rather than tell them why, I'll give you my opinion is that it may be several or couple different entities. If I have an assisted living business and I have a building that they're working out of, I don't want that in the same business. I want to keep that legally separated from each other because both the building itself and the assisted living operations have their own share of liability that could fall on them. So what are you thinking for the operations side of it, Tony?
Well, the operations side is going to go in a corporation.
That's kind of what I was
saying. We need to decide, to the point of their question, then we need to decide if that operation is going to be a C or an S corporation.
Correct. And part of my analysis is depending on the number of employees you have in the business, it may lean more towards an S corporation. I don't know. How do you feel about that?
For me, it depends. If you spent a lot of money up front on training, education, mentoring, and the like, and this is not a line of business you were in before, we're going to look at a C corporation. If okay. you have a lot of medical expenses and things of this nature, we're going to look at a C corporation. Especially if you have both of those two things combined, we're going to look at a C corporation. But that doesn't mean that we always have to be a C corporation either.
I was just going to move to the property itself. That I would probably put in a partnership. And you could have it managed by another entity. It could be managed by a C corp. But what you don't want it to do is be managed by the same C corporation that's running the assisted living business.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you've just messed your liability protection together and you're not protected at all.
Very good point. Very good point. All right, let's keep rolling. I bought some dirt and am building a house for resale. Do I need to keep it for a year before selling for long-term capital gains? Is my basis in the lot and building costs? So,
and what do we call this, Tony? Yeah, go ahead.
It doesn't matter how long you hold the property. It's about your intent. So if your intent going in is to build a house and sell it, it's going to be a ordinary income. If you build a house and hold it long term, hold it out for rent, then that'll be different. Then you've turned it into a capital asset instead of inventory, and you would then be able to sell it at the long term capital gains rates. Jeff?
Yeah, no, that's a great point, and that's exactly what I was thinking. If I build it and
they
sell
will come.
It, yeah, I was going to go there, but I decided I'm a dad. I can't do that.
I did it.
If you build it and they come and they buy it, and that is a flip, it's going to be taxed as ordinary income. It's not going to be subject to long-term capital gains or any kind of capital gains, no matter how long you hold it. But like Tony said, if you build it and set it up to rent, then it's going to be subject to capital gains if you do later sell it. And ideally, if you can place it in service and rent it out for a year and then sell it at the end of the year, you're going to get those long-term capital gains rates. And the clock starts ticking from the time that the building is available for rent, not when it's actually rented out. So if you advertise it for 2 or 3 months, then you have to wait another 9 or 10 months of renting it out to get those long-term rates.
And is my basis the lot and building cost? Yes. So if you do, in fact, turn this into a long-term hold, and we are talking about basis, it's going to be how much you paid for the lot and how much you paid for the build. Is your basis that you're going to use for depreciation. In this case, it's inventory, so it's just going to be your cost of goods sold. All right, let's go. What do we got next? Okay, If there are no capital gains, this is heavy on capital gains today. If there are no capital gains on selling a house in one state, but the former owners moved to a new state prior to the sale, are there taxes in the new state?
So how this works is, if you have sell a property in a state that has a tax, that state is always going to tax that sale. Whether you live in New York and you sell a property in California, California is going to tax that sale. Where you live at the time of sale is also going to tax that. So back to the California, New York, you're a New York resident. California is going to tax it first. They're going to get their piece. New York is also going to include that sale in your income. However, anytime you have the same income being taxed by two states, normally your resident state, sometimes the other state, gives you a credit for taxes paid to the other state. So you're not going to be paying double taxes, but you will be filing returns in both states to report that income.
Mm-hmm. All right. Very good. Let's keep going. Unless you had something else. Oh, was that it?
Hey, it's 358.
Oh, wow. Okay. So thanks for providing us with all of your questions. Replays are available in your Platinum portal of Tax Tuesday. Mm-hmm. You can also get them from Anderson Advisors podcast, Anderson Business Advisors podcast. Just get that right. Absolutely free.
Yep. Apple Play and Google Play.
Mm-hmm. And we talked about the Anderson events. Don't forget to go ahead and check that out as well. We want to educate. That is what we are all about. Follow us on Facebook. I don't know how you follow.
You subscribe.
You know, you do all the different things. You like. You do all the different things with Anderson on Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn, Instagram, and Twitter. And as always, you can give us a call if you'd like to schedule a consult to speak with our wonderful staff. If you have questions, send them to taxtuesday@andersonadvisors.com or visit andersonadvisors.com. And we will answer, by we, I mean Toby, will answer those questions for you as we did today. And we still have our team members in the chat answering questions for you that you're submitting as they come through. Thanks again so much for joining us. I hope that I was an acceptable fill-in for Toby.
No, I was just going to say, Tony, thanks for filling in. And it worked out real well. And these poor listeners will get to be able to eat supper on time on this Tuesday.
I know. If you're a Platinum client, you can join me on Platinum Office Hours in now.
Till next time. Thanks again, Tony.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at andersonadvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast, and if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.